For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. The National Weather Service is investigating two distinct tornado paths that crossed through St. John the Baptist Parish in Louisiana. One of the paths goes through a community where as many as 200 homes were damaged late yesterday. To the west, a tornado ravaged an RV park and convent, killing two people and injuring about 30 others. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards told WVUE the devastation left by the storm is unbelievable.
The saying is, a picture's worth a thousand words. It is a jumbled mess. These travel trailers were picked up, moved considerable distance, and really blown apart, torn apart.
The storms killed another person in Mississippi and damaged about 100 homes in Pensacola, Florida. Thousands in the Gulf Coast region are still without power. That same line of storms is bringing the threat of straight-line winds and tornadoes to our state today. The Nevada Republican Party is reporting that attendance at its Tuesday night caucus set a new record. The party says more than 75,000 voters attended the caucus. That's more than twice the 33,000 who caucused in 2012. Nevada's Republican caucuses have been plagued by low attendance and other problems since they began in 2008. Democrats have seen stronger turnout numbers. They reported more than 84,000 caucus goers in their caucuses Saturday. As expected, the relatively high turnout Tuesday powered Donald Trump to a commanding victory. After his win, Trump greeted supporters at a rally.
We love Nevada. We love Nevada. Thank you. Thank you. This is a great place.
Marco Rubio took second and Ted Cruz came in third. Rubio and Cruz have been attacking each other viciously in recent days, an indication they know Trump can be stopped only if one of them is eliminated. After winning now in New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, Trump has momentum heading into Super Tuesday. Elsewhere, Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid has endorsed Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination. Reid participated in his state's Democratic caucuses Saturday, but voted as uncommitted. Reid said he took pains to remain neutral in the competition between Clinton and Bernie Sanders so he would not be accused of rigging the caucuses. Speaking of elections, locally, Time Warner Cable News will debut Decision 2016, Make Your Vote Count, a special on North Carolina's voting process this Friday, February 26th at 7:30 p.m. Anchor Tim Boyum, who you can also hear every Friday right here on What Matters at 4 p.m., and the network's news team will provide viewers with a comprehensive overview of North Carolina's political parties, break down the changes in the state's voting laws, and offer a thorough look into voter resources. The program will be re-aired several times throughout the weekend. A federal judge gave opponents to North Carolina's congressional redistricting maps until Monday to outline their objections. The News and Observer reports U.S. District Court Judge William Osteen Jr. asked the plaintiffs to state with specificity the factual and legal basis for each objection. The plaintiffs sued the state over its 2011 maps that redrew its 13 congressional districts. A three-judge panel ruled February 5th that the maps were unconstitutional and ordered the state to come up with new ones. The plaintiffs now argue that those newly drawn maps, passed into law last week by the General Assembly, are no more appropriate than the versions that were struck down. They proposed a schedule for the court to review the new maps, which included court hearings March 11th, and a final decision by the court no later than March 18th, and also recommended the judges draw their own map if they don't like the new boundaries. The legislature had proposed candidate filing under the new maps begin March 16th. Defendants have until March 7th to file a response to the plaintiff's objections, and plaintiffs have until March 9th to reply. The judge said in his order any request for more time would be viewed with disfavor. If the new maps and filing period remain in force, North Carolina's congressional primaries will be June 7th. And there's a gathering taking place right now, and it's not what you may think. 50 or more bald eagles can be found in the cold of winter at Jordan Lake, a 14,000-acre reservoir near the RTP. The miles of undeveloped shoreline are a natural habitat for the eagles. For the national bird of the United States, the hunting there is good. Jordan Lake has more than a dozen active nests this winter. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now it's time to find out what matters with Chad Adams.
Please stand by. We now take you live to the Institute of Rational Thought for a special broadcast. Hard-hitting interviews and relevant information to make your day. It's Chad Adams.
Wow. Political storms, real storms, and then LGBT storms. So it's just a minefield out there. And folks, I hope if you're listening to this live between the hours of 3 and 5, there are multiple tornado watches, warnings, blustery conditions. I just saw the latest map that I have seen a copy of sent to me from folks inside the know, so to speak, from the National Weather Service, a very succinct, tight. It's an interesting map, because if you look at the map, it delineates North Carolina from a line from the south to the north, basically from the South Carolina line to the Virginia line, and it shows the line of storms that are, as of this live broadcast at 3, a line of storms going around, you know, Greensboro, Asheboro, down toward Monroe. And those will proceed ever so slowly, about an hour, you know, through the central part of the state. They'll be in the Raleigh market around the 5 p.m., right in time for rush hour traffic. And then slightly east of Raleigh between 5 and 6. Could be interesting, could be bad. Hopefully it won't be, and hopefully, you know, for those of you listening in the rebroadcast or the podcast or via terrestrial down in the Kannapolis area in China Grove, we hope you're all safe and sound. So a lot going on out there. And when I talk to people, I've talked to a number of folks today, because as I'm reading the news, there's a lot happening, but what's really interesting? And in the poll, an informal, unscientific poll, so what's important? Most people, about 5, said Trump. What's in the news? What's interesting? Trump. The situation last night with Trump, there is no doubt in Nevada, there was no doubt that Trump was going to win, but what does this portend for Cruz and Rubio trying to, you know, that are on the heels that were hoping for some kind of convincing second place finish? Alas, it did not occur the way either had wanted to. And it also broke a ceiling that many people thought Trump would never hit. We'll talk a little bit about that. Also, obviously, we've already talked about the weather. Then the bond issue still out there, but not the bond, but the LGBT issue in Charlotte. The unisex, non-sex, whatever kind of sex you feel you are on a given day, at a given place and time and space, and I don't know, that you can go to the bathroom, whatever bathroom you want to go to, as of April 1st in Charlotte, and the city of Charlotte's going to force you as a business owner to do what they have said do. So, and I've cautioned some of my Republican friends to try to get them to consider that a knee-jerk reaction from the right is no better than a knee-jerk reaction from the left. And so there's a much more methodical way to think about this. And how I said this, now, I have often been critical of the Speaker of the House, Tim Moore. I think that he is ideologically without a rudder. That's not a mean thing to say. I think his voting record bears it out. He's been, look, the left likes him. Democrats like him. His budget was bloated and full of pork that he and Nelson Dollar put together. It was horrific. I mean, the fact that he hasn't been able to keep a rein on his rules chairman who changes laws in the middle of the night for a donor shows that I just don't know that he's got a really good grasp of leadership. Doesn't mean he's a bad person. Doesn't mean he's anything like that. We've tried to get him on the show. He's kind of reluctant to do so. He's busy. He's the Speaker. So this came out to the caucus members not too long ago. It was sent out, and this is what's funny, because a lot of people in the caucus do talk to a lot of different folks. And here's, I think there's a cautionary tale here. So the governor called for a special session of the legislature last week to deal with the maps, the legislative maps, because of the Fourth Circuit. It was absolutely something the governor should have done. The governor has the right to call that. Now, the governor has also said to the city of Charlotte, to many folks there, he disagrees with this move. He told people before the vote he doesn't like it, and he feels that it's going to be addressed. He has shown leadership on the issue of how people feel about the. Who would have thought that bathrooms would be such an issue in North Carolina? The oddly silent, but not oddly silent, Roy Cooper has ducked this issue. He is avoiding it. He is avoiding it, avoiding it, avoid. He has no comment. And it's interesting that the media has not gone to him to ask him how he feels about this. Not WRAL. No media source can I find to quote News and Observer. Nobody. What does Roy Cooper say? He is supportive of this mayor. They have held fundraisers together. They are on the same team politically. The governor has been very clear about where he stands. The aspiring governor, the attorney general of the state of North Carolina, that likely would have to enforce any law that the legislature changes to deal with the city of Charlotte, is silent. The great silent coop. In fact, Roy Cooper has flown the political coop. not in action, absent, AWOL. You want to be governor? If you want to be governor of the state, you have to answer some questions. It's time for you to answer some questions. So that all being said, so I'm not giving Roy Cooper a free pass. The governor has said how he feels. So Tim Moore, back to the Speaker of the House. He has sent out a letter to the caucus members, and he's saying, I am emailing to gauge your interest in coming in for special session. Again, typos. This is a speaker's office that cannot communicate with grammar. They don't, they're not even checking their public notes. This is the you would think at the highest levels of government in North Carolina that you would at least get to be able to grammatically get your stuff straight. You would think. Look, I know, having been an editor, and it's easy for me to mangle the English language, but when I'm communicating professionally, you communicate professionally. Even here, we aspire to do it right. And this is in live radio. This is recorded, but we do it live. I am emailing, this is from the Speaker of the House, Tim Moore. I am emailing to gauge your interest in coming in for special session to deal with the recent radical actions of the Charlotte City Council that I believe pose a real danger to public safety concerning the sexual identity and bathroom matters, as well as the related mandates upon private businesses. That's one sentence, by the way. In grammar school, we called it a run-on sentence. Attention, Molly Young. You might want to edit this stuff before sending it out. If we do not act, comma, the Charlotte Ordinance will go into effect on April 1st, and we do not return to the short session until April 25th. And then in bold, if I get enough response in favor, 72 members, I will ask Senator Berger to join me in calling a special session. While special sessions are costly, and here's the pander bear part of this, we cannot put a price tag on the safety of women and children. By the way, women and children, extra space between and children. So double space, another typo. Please respond with your position on this as soon as possible. Thank you, Tim. Speaker Tim Moore. Now, the cautionary tale here is there is the ability to have a knee-jerk reaction. There is the ability to, you know, I guess the question, what do you pass? You're saying you're there to protect the safety of women and children. Well, the city of Charlotte and the citizens there have a choice to make. There needs to be an uprising from that city. Those people need to have an uprising within their ranks. The city of Charlotte needs to come together, and this needs to come from them. The dictatorial powers of the General Assembly being heaped upon Charlotte, you can fix it. But all you're going to do is give them credibility on saying, look at what they did. They're crushing their bullies. They're blah, blah, blah. They'll try to portray Republicans as a bunch of Neanderthals in a way. Go cautiously on this one. We're on the right side. What Charlotte did was wrong. There is no other way. Tammy Fitzgerald did a stellar job of discussing this. And this is something that needs to be thought through. There's no reason it needs to be a knee-jerk reaction. And, you know, I'm not sure why, if I get enough response in favor, 72 members, you would think 61 members is the majority. But I, for some reason, Tim Moore said 72. I guess that's close to everyone, if every single person kind of responds. I'm not sure how he comes up with the number 72. And I wish he could at least typographically do this correct. But the real danger here is to overreach with public policy. To overreach with dictatorial powers. Now, Tim Moore is from that area. Many of his lieutenants, like Kelly Hastings, they're from that area. It would be interesting to see. But again, why is there not, you know, if 5,000 people came to the General Assembly from Charlotte to make the case this is wrong, if business owners would come together, unify, and challenge the city council, that is where this is a great opportunity for a grassroots movement, not dictatorial quashing powers from the General Assembly. Ugh. Okay, to be fair, the sentence in bold may not have been in bold. Eh. Tim Moore. But again, we've got to be very, very careful here. Because right now, the left has done something foolish. It has done something really stupid. It has done something without a lot of thought to it. It has pandered to a tiny, tiny, tiny portion of the electorate. It went overboard. It went way beyond the pale. And I do not think that they even realize the damage they've done. It's a golden opportunity to show leadership. I think the governor has done so. I think it is time to get citizens in that area. If Tim Moore and the rest of the General Assembly want to really make a difference, go down and campaign in Charlotte. Get a grassroots campaign going. Get the people to see you're on their side. Get businesses excited about changing this. Get them to make a recommendation for the changes. Let it come from there. Let it come from that queen city, appropriately named at this point in time for some odd reason. Let it come from there. This is not being imposed on the rest of the citizens of the state. This is what Charlotte has done to cut its own throat. There are many other options on the table that the General Assembly should have considered if they want Charlotte to comply. They can withhold funds. They can let Charlotte change it. You got to choose. What do you want? Do you want more taxpayer dollars? Or do you want a reverse course? Why don't you reverse course and we'll treat you like every other city in the state? You don't want a reverse course? We're going to treat you like the single city you are out there, alone on the outpost of the left. So we got to be careful here. That's all I'm saying. Just be careful. And we will have Paul Chesser on with us from the Carolina Plowdown. I'm sure this will be a discussion that we will have with him. It is interesting that the governor has not called for a special session, but we got much more to discuss there. And then later on, we'll have Professor Andrew Taylor on with us discussing what happened a little bit last night. But he's written an article kind of framing the economic, relative economic differences between the left and right in this presidential campaign, and they are worth mentioning. They are definitely worth discussing because there's no way this comes together real quickly. Much more to discuss here. And also, what happened with the magic word threshold that has people talking? We'll talk about that as it relates to Trump. So much more to go here on What Matters with Chad Adams. Stay tuned.
Attention, conservatives. Don't miss your chance to hear from former Congressman Colonel Alan West, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, Ann McElhaney, Dinesh D'Souza, and David Limbaugh March 4th and 5th. The Civitas Institute invites you to the 2016 Conservative Leadership Conference in Raleigh. Get your tickets online at civitasclc.com. That's CIVITASCLC.com. Join the Civitas Institute and hundreds of fellow conservatives to hear from inspiring leaders and dynamic speakers from the Heritage Foundation, Americans for Prosperity, the Civitas Institute, and many more. Go to CivitasCLC.com. That's CIVITASCLC.com. It's time to stand up for the principles that made our country great. Learn how at the 2016 Conservative Leadership Conference, March 4th and 5th at the Embassy Suites Cary. Register at CivitasCLC.com or call 919-834-2099. That's 919-834-2099.
Oh, take a deep breath. Breathe it out. Welcome to Zen Conservative Radio. Glad to have you with us on this stormy, blustery, interesting straight line, hail, damaging winds day. And also, there's bad weather outside, so politically. Now, the other thing, when I read through the note from Speaker Moore, he says, if I get a response in favor, and he highlights the phrase 72 members, there are 74 Republicans in the caucus. 61 is a majority of the 120 members. So 72 is kind of a strange number. He never delineates why. But you would think that Molly Young and people in the Speaker's office would at least correct it for grammar because it makes them look less than educated. He's an educated guy. He's a lawyer. He's an attorney. Just makes it's kind of embarrassing. Oh. Anyway, so going on to the issue with Donald Trump, there's no way that you cannot discuss this. And in this way, I'm going to spend most of it talking about Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, because when you're looking through what's going on with the caucus, with the national situation. So Donald Trump wins convincingly out in Nevada. He has won South Carolina, and now he's won three in a row. So New Hampshire, South Carolina, and on to Nevada. Cruz and Rubio had a less than stellar performance in those states. There's no way that you can portray it any other way. People are upset. People are angry, whatever. And so over at National Review, a group that really doesn't like Trump at all, okay? And now I'm having trouble pulling it up. It's kind of interesting that they've got a piece. Bill Kristol has a piece over there that is just kind of embarrassing. It's a rough night for Cruz, Rubio, as Trump breezes to victory in Nevada. So when you read through this, it's by Alexis Levinson. And he says, last night, shortly after 10 p.m., the fire alarm went off at Ted Cruz's caucus night party in a YMCA gym. By the time Cruz surrogate Glenn Beck, speaking of alarmist, took the stage, about 30 seconds later, all was quiet. But with Donald Trump already assured of a crushing victory over the rest of his competitors in Nevada, the keening alarm seemed an almost too on-the-nose expression of how poorly the night and the past few days had gone for Cruz. Nevada was supposed to be about who won the battle for second place, Cruz or Marco Rubio, each vying to emerge as the lone anti-Trump candidate. How many of you have you've seen this? Every one of us watching this from afar. First place, as it was in South Carolina and New Hampshire before, it appeared a foregone conclusion, so much so that another Trump win hardly seemed noteworthy. But on Tuesday night, the real estate mogul broke 40%. Now, this is significant, folks. Back to the column. Winning his third nominating contest in a row and trouncing his two most serious competitors by almost 20 points. Instead of further clarifying who would be best able to take on Trump, the Nevada caucus raised doubts as to whether anyone could take him on at all. Late in the evening, a noticeably subdued Ted Cruz took the stage before a small crowd gathered at the basketball court at YMCA. Gone was the bravado with which he'd spun a disappointing third-place finish in South Carolina just 3 days earlier. There was no talk of how Nevada had helped the campaign, quote, defy expectations of pundits. No claim to have effectively tied for a second. In fact, there was almost no mention of Nevada at all. In the wake of a second straight loss, Cruz and his surrogates were looking forward to Super Tuesday in the Texas primary. Tonight, he said, I'll sleep in my bed for the first time in a month. And then it's back in the campaign trail in Texas and all across Super Tuesday. Rubio was about 12 hours ahead of Cruz in skipping out of the Silver State. The Florida senator had left earlier that morning, headed for Minnesota, a Super Tuesday contest, and Michigan, which votes on March 8th. But Trump's win on Tuesday night poses, and this is what I'm getting to earlier, poses problems for both Cruz and Rubio that cannot be left behind in Nevada. Both senators have argued that Trump has a ceiling of support somewhere in the mid-30s. Trump has, quote, got a ceiling where between 60 and 70% of primary voters don't believe he is the person to be the Republican nominee, Cruz told reporters in Vegas just this past Monday. But on Tuesday night, Trump blew right past that mark, with 88% of precincts reporting Trump was over 45%. At events around Nevada in the past few days, Rubio had pitched himself as the best shot for Republicans to win to beat a Democrat nominee in November. His message was one of inclusion. He promised to expand the party and give Republicans a general election shot at Latino-heavy swing states like Nevada. But according to CNN exit polls, 45% of Latino voters backed Trump on Tuesday. Rubio was a distant second with 28%. Exit polls aren't entirely reliable, and the sample of Latino voters in question was very small, but it's a feat that Trump proudly touted Tuesday night in his victory speech, and one that would seem to undercut the argument that he can't win a general election. Unsurprisingly, again, this is National Review. This is the group that can't stand Trump, that put out on its banner and put out before the first elections. It was like, Trump is going to end the world, basically. So this is from National Review. Unsurprisingly, given the dysfunctional state of the Nevada GOP, chaos reigned supreme during the caucuses, with long lines, uninformed volunteers, reports of people being handed more than one ballot, and reports of ballots being improperly filed, among other things. But it appeared unlikely that either Rubio or Cruz's campaigns would contest the results and drag out the misery. As everything was dying down, Nevada Lieutenant Governor Mark Hutchinson, a top surrogate for Rubio, told reporters in Vegas that, despite what he had heard and seen of the chaos, he had no reason now to believe the results won't be credible. Next interesting point. So Trump broke through the 40% barrier easily in Nevada, heading into Super Tuesday. The Nevada Republican caucuses saw record turnout. What we're seeing record turnout everywhere. The Nevada Republican caucuses saw record turnout Tuesday night, with 88% of precincts reporting. Nearly 67,000 votes had already been counted. That dwarfed. Now, if I were to ask you, how many votes do you think Mitt Romney and company got in 2012? How many votes do you think turned out in 2008 for Republicans? In 2012, it was 33,000. In 2008, it was 44,000. This year, 67,000, 2-1 over 2012. And that, despite the process's embarrassing hiccups, makes it hard to dismiss the results as a fluke. For most of the cycle, Nevada has largely been an afterthought. After tonight's results, last night's results, Cruz and Rubio likely wish it had remained one. The important point here is that there will come a time where there has to be a coalescing. Now, I think it's way too early to prognosticate that Trump is going to run away with this. I think 7% of the total delegates cast have been cast. So we're a long way away. I mean, many people will say, hey, it's Trump's to lose. I agree with that sentiment. He's got to get through Super Tuesday. And even if a lot of those Super Tuesday delegates will be delegated proportionally. So Rubio's going to get some delegates. Cruz is going to get some delegates. Carson's going to get some delegates. Trump will probably get the lion's share of those delegates that day. But here's the point. There comes a point in time where you realize the attrition of candidates on the Republican side hasn't bumped up everyone. With Bush leaving, everyone thought Rubio would just bounce. Little bounce, but some of those votes are going to Trump. When these other candidates leave, some of those votes are going to Donald Trump. And that's going to be very interesting because there comes a point in time, if you need to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, whether you're Cruz or Rubio or Trump, one of these three will take that nomination, unless there's a very strange brokered convention, in which case the American public will probably abandon the Republicans altogether for the most part. They got to put it back together again. These people will have to come back and find a way to support one another. So we'll see what happens there. We will definitely see what happens there. And just as we were on the air just now, I got another alert. My home county has a tornado touching down. Chatham and Lee have their warning. So far, all of the tornadoes thus far that we've heard, I haven't seen reports of damages, and you know, we hope there aren't any, but we'll see. We'll see, but certainly we hope everyone remains safe. Now, when we get back, we're going to get into our good buddy. Well, we're going to get into the Carolina Plothound. Okay. And if you don't get it, if you haven't seen it before, and I know some of you may not have, Carolina Plothound, the news aggregator site, and I will talk about this later in the show, but the headline today has to do with the congressional redistricting. And we'll talk with Paul some about that, but just briefly, when they redrew the maps, for those of you not attuned with all of the sporadic details, it looked like, I mean, there were certain people that were drawn into or out of districts. It was fascinating that, you know, Alma Adams was drawn out of one, her district, and mostly now the 12th is down in Charlotte. She's way up near Greensboro. Scott Walker drawn out of his district, thrown into the 13th. His district is the 6th. He was no longer in it. All of Renee Elmer's people were drawn out. I mean, meaning all of Renee Elmer's opponents were drawn out of her district. And George Holding, one of the most financially successful folks ever to get in politics in North Carolina, was drawn out of his district. His district was moved 120 miles to the west, so he found himself in downtown Raleigh stranded. You had to think, was this intentional? There's no way they could have thought that George Holding was just going to say, well, got drawn out of my district, I'm done. No, 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 no. I mean, the ink wasn't even dry on the maps being read to the media. And by the way, those maps have been around for a couple weeks. You can tell. Why can you tell? Because House and Senate members are jumping into races, you know, like fleas on a dog through a junkyard. They are just jumping into congressional races all over the place. They knew this was coming. They knew. It's been a couple weeks. They've seen the maps. They've been told, hey, we're going to change the law so that you guys can jump in the race and all will be well. But George Holding is going to be, I mean, if Renee Elmers thought Jim Duncan was going to be tough, and Jim Duncan would have been, George Holding is a just an unbelievable force to be reckoned with in the 2nd Congressional District. Renee Elmers may be going home, and we will talk more about that in the second hour, and certainly we'll be talking a little bit, you know, with Paul Chester about it. And also, I got a note from Chester. Oh, by the way, another one. 8th Congressional District GOP chairman resigns to challenge Pittenger in the redesigned 9th District. Former Congressman Robin Hayes endorses Pittenger opponent George Rauco. So again, I've predicted it's going to be kind of crazy. It's going to be kind of crazy as we go through things. We'll be right back with our buddy Paul Chester. We're going to take a quick break. We're keeping an eye on the weather. If anything happens, we'll certainly let you know about it. Much more to go. Stay tuned here on What Matters with Chad Adams.
For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. The National Weather Service is investigating two distinct tornado paths that crossed through St. John the Baptist Parish in Louisiana. One of the paths goes through a community where as many as 200 homes were damaged late yesterday. To the west, a tornado ravaged an RV park and convent, killing two people and injuring about 30 others. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards told WVUE the devastation left by the storm is unbelievable.
The saying is, a picture's worth a thousand words. It is a jumbled mess. These travel trailers were picked up, moved considerable distance, and really blown apart, torn apart.
The storms killed another person in Mississippi and damaged about 100 homes in Pensacola, Florida. Thousands in the Gulf Coast region are still without power. That same line of storms is bringing the threat of straight-line winds and tornadoes to our state today. The Nevada Republican Party is reporting that attendance at its Tuesday night caucus set a new record. The party says more than 75,000 voters attended the caucus. That's more than twice the 33,000 who caucused in 2012. Nevada's Republican caucuses have been plagued by low attendance and other problems since they began in 2008. Democrats have seen stronger turnout numbers. They reported more than 84,000 caucus goers in their caucuses Saturday. As expected, the relatively high turnout Tuesday powered Donald Trump to a commanding victory. After his win, Trump greeted supporters at a rally.
We love Nevada. We love Nevada. Thank you. Thank you. This is a great place.
Marco Rubio took second and Ted Cruz came in third. Rubio and Cruz have been attacking each other viciously in recent days, an indication they know Trump can be stopped only if one of them is eliminated. After winning now in New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, Trump has momentum heading into Super Tuesday. Elsewhere, Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid has endorsed Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination. Reid participated in his state's Democratic caucuses Saturday, but voted as uncommitted. Reid said he took pains to remain neutral in the competition between Clinton and Bernie Sanders so he would not be accused of rigging the caucuses. Speaking of elections, locally, Time Warner Cable News will debut Decision 2016, Make Your Vote Count, a special on North Carolina's voting process this Friday, February 26th at 7:30 p.m. Anchor Tim Boyum, who you can also hear every Friday right here on What Matters at 4 p.m., and the network's news team will provide viewers with a comprehensive overview of North Carolina's political parties, break down the changes in the state's voting laws, and offer a thorough look into voter resources. The program will be re-aired several times throughout the weekend. A federal judge gave opponents to North Carolina's congressional redistricting maps until Monday to outline their objections. The News and Observer reports U.S. District Court Judge William Osteen Jr. asked the plaintiffs to state with specificity the factual and legal basis for each objection. The plaintiffs sued the state over its 2011 maps that redrew its 13 congressional districts. A three-judge panel ruled February 5th that the maps were unconstitutional and ordered the state to come up with new ones. The plaintiffs now argue that those newly drawn maps, passed into law last week by the General Assembly, are no more appropriate than the versions that were struck down. They proposed a schedule for the court to review the new maps, which included court hearings March 11th, and a final decision by the court no later than March 18th, and also recommended the judges draw their own map if they don't like the new boundaries. The legislature had proposed candidate filing under the new maps begin March 16th. Defendants have until March 7th to file a response to the plaintiff's objections, and plaintiffs have until March 9th to reply. The judge said in his order any request for more time would be viewed with disfavor. If the new maps and filing period remain in force, North Carolina's congressional primaries will be June 7th. And there's a gathering taking place right now, and it's not what you may think. 50 or more bald eagles can be found in the cold of winter at Jordan Lake, a 14,000-acre reservoir near the RTP. The miles of undeveloped shoreline are a natural habitat for the eagles. For the national bird of the United States, the hunting there is good. Jordan Lake has more than a dozen active nests this winter. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now back to more of What Matters with Chad Adams.
Good afternoon, folks. Glad to have you with us here on the Freedom Action Network's What Matters with Chad Adams. And with us right now, and we're going to try to, it's always fun when we're Skyping because we haven't, Paul doesn't have a microphone, but he has the one built into his computer. How are you today, Paul?
I'm doing good. How are you?
We have Paul Chester from the Carolina Plot Hound, and you have a busy day, don't you? I mean, we're tracking weather systems and storms and tornado warnings, and you're tracking just the most bizarre series of stories. You've got redistricting. You've got the Connect NC bond stuff. Whoa, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, what was that? Sounded like a cat jumped up on your computer.
It did. I don't like that. My dog would do something like that.
And then not only that, so you've got all of the redistricting stuff. You've got all of the Connect NC stuff that's out there. And then you've got green energy and all that crazy stuff out there. So where would you like to begin? Because, you've got some really good stories. I'd like to start out with this green school stuff.
It's just your average day on Plot Hound.
There's nothing average about this day. I mean, you've got North Carolina schools that claim they are green, fail to produce energy savings, and end up costing taxpayers more.
Yeah, I'm having some technical difficulties here.
Please stand by.
That's actually a study published by the Locke Foundation, but it was worked on by a guy at the Washington Policy Center, Todd Myers. He's a friend of mine, and he's done a number of these studies. I've helped him edit the stories a little bit reports a little bit, where he gets data from various school districts and states. He's done Washington State already. He's done Colorado and Nevada, and North Carolina is his fourth, or actually I think he's done a little in New Mexico as well. And basically what he does is he gets electricity bills and utility data from various school districts, looks at the different schools, their dimensions, their characteristics, when they were built, tries to do as best as he can an apples to apples comparison on how the quote green schools do versus traditionally built schools. So, some of these green schools might have, larger windows. They might have, different things, aspects to their system or to their construction that makes them quote green, or what that really means is the LEED, L-E-E-D design. I forget what that acronym stands for. But, and his findings are that these schools that are supposed to be green, and that mostly these school districts pay more money for upfront in construction costs, actually don't save energy. They don't perform any better, and often they perform much worse than the schools that are just built under a standard construction model.
Yeah, that's the leadership in energy and environmental design. I mean, you have like the convention center in Wilmington has these LEED. More and more cities are trying to force taxpayers to fund these LEED building designs, and they're more costly. They're much more costly, and based on what you're saying, if we do all this, so we're getting hit up front, we're not necessarily saving money. Why do you think all of these LEED buildings, you would think they would, at the very least, since they cost more money to build, there would be some savings on the backside. But you're saying that's not true.
Right. Well, what he finds is, they say that, they put bigger windows in a lot of these schools, and I don't know what the justification is for that as far as, lighting quality, I guess, is one reason for that. But what Todd Myers finds is that it obviously is not as good an insulator. So it doesn't, it takes a lot more energy in the late spring and early summer and also in the winter to maintain the climate in these schools. And, there's just a lot of different aspects to it. A lot of these upfront costs and, the LEED system is based upon a point system. So they, they get credit for things like putting bike racks in front of the school and different things like that, and basically it's just kind of a thing to brag about for these school systems. But when you looked at how they practically perform, they don't come through.
It's interesting. They cost a lot more money, but the savings are just not there. Even U.S. News documented this years ago. I mean, I'm kind of astounded we're still heading down this path. They warned us back in 2014, you know, leading taxpayers to waste money. Policymakers need to take a hard look at LEED certification standards. And yet cities are continuing to embrace stuff that does not work. It does not save taxpayers. It's costing us millions.
Right. Well, you know, there's just like there's been in the whole renewable energy industry and wind and solar and alternative fuels. And there's been a whole, now there's been a whole industry or part of an industry, part of the construction industry built up around this LEED design. It's architecture firms, it's builders, it's developers. And that's a selling point for them where they say, you know, we can help you come into compliance or get to the point where you're LEED certified, and there's different levels of being LEED certified, and you know, they make money off of it. And you know, just like you know, the false claims made about solar and wind energy and how it can compete with fossil fuels as far as delivery and cost and such, it's the LEED, you know, the green buildings are not showing to be perform as well as the traditional bit. You know, people know, I think my house was built in 2010, and you know, all these building requirements now, they only allow you to put certain breakers in your electric panels. Right. They only allow, you know, you have to have low flow toilets and all these, yep, things. Well, all this stuff just does not perform. I've never had a house where breakers trip like they do.
And they also require you to put those crazy light bulbs in. Those, yeah, light bulbs that you basically have to call a, you know, a hazmat team in to clean up when one breaks.
Right. And so.
And they don't last 2 years. They do blow. Those lights do blow. I've had them in houses. Right. I'm just saying they do go out. It's just, they're supposed to last five times as long, but some of them,
yeah,
don't.
Yeah. And, you know, where are the studies that have looked at that? You know, and where this, and you know, this is kind of unique. I mean, I'm sure there's been a few studies here and there of these green building, you know, performance results. But you know, Todd Myers at the Washington Policy Center has been doing this now consistently, and you know, he's been finding consistently that they don't measure up to what their claims are. And you know what? Big surprise. The environmentalists are not coming through on the promises that they make.
Just amazing. You have a funny story before we get to some more serious ones about a Wilmington teacher. I'm assuming you said not a homeschool, so it's a government-run public school. A Wilmington teacher.
It's not a government school. This is the Wilmington Academy of Arts and Science.
Okay. It's a bizarre assignment, though. And yeah. I thought about it on multiple levels, and I was like, you know, maybe there's a reason. But it's requiring students to carry all their trash around with them for 24 hours. It just seems like kind of a bizarre course or assignment.
Well, yeah. I mean, the story is interesting in that there's no quotes from kids who are complaining about it. They just are, you know, saying, oh, I'm learning, you know, that how much trash I produce and, you know, how much recycling I might be throwing away is what one student says. I'm much more aware of how much trash I actually produce. Okay, that's, you know, this is a nice little exercise if you're interested in, you know, seeing what kind of trash you generate or toss away on a daily basis. But I don't think it's an appropriate thing for a teacher to mandate that a student participate in, you know, from the schoolroom to walking around the school halls to riding home on the school bus in their parents' car, walking around their house. You know, has she gotten buy-in from their parents? You know, there's an agenda here too. There's a practical aspect to it. And I just don't see that addressed in this story. I find it interesting that they wouldn't even look at that. It's total buy-in from the students. It's total buy-in from the reporter and WECT who reported this story. And, you know, nothing that – it's an uncritical story. So I just thought it was interesting.
Very.
In that respect.
Now, let's turn our attention over. There's two more topics I want to try to get to before we get to the top of the hour. And one of those has to do with the redistricting. You're covering, you're doing as good a job of any of trying to keep track of all the different people that are jumping in this. I mean, at a certain point, I'm having trouble keeping, so many people are starting to jump in these races, I'm having trouble keeping track of them. We haven't even gotten clearance from the courts that they're going to accept the maps that have been submitted. There's a lot of time, effort, energy, money that's already been spent. Now we're in round two. The maps haven't been finalized. What's your take on these? I mean, you've got the 8th Congressional District GOP chairman running in the redesigned 9th. Robin Hayes endorsing people against Robert Pittenger. It seems like a crazy time right now.
It is. You know, most of my conservative friends that I hear from, you know, who actually pay attention to what these new districts look like, say, yeah, these are better maps. They're more constitutional, both state constitution and not as gerrymandered looking. Even some liberals are saying that, you know, I mean, they're not saying they like them, but, you know, Thomas Mills, who runs a blog, Politics NC, and he was actually running against Richard Hudson in the 8th district, in the old 8th district. I don't know if he's going to still do that, but he says that the maps are better. And I can't remember who the other one was, but it was another liberal. Oh, it's a writer for the Triad City Beat, an alternative newspaper in Greensboro, said the maps are better and fairer. So, you know, on that level, you know, I guess it's okay, but, you know, what if I don't know. Do you know this? Is it possible the Supreme Court will come back and say, okay, the maps are all right. The old maps were okay. And we went through all this exercise for no reason. I don't know what the timing is expected on the decision on the old maps.
I don't either. I there's so many unknowns here.
But if they come back and say the old maps are in effect, that's going to even generate.
It's going to be more bizarre.
They're going to vote on March 15th. They're going to have, you know, all these votes cast on March 15th with the old maps still on the ballot.
Which are going to just be thrown out. They'll just be thrown out. They won't be counted. Yeah. It'll be an interesting polling. It'll be an interesting poll of districts that are not there.
Regardless, we're locked into the second primary election.
Oh, there's no doubt we are. And remember, in this specific congressional race, there will be no runoff. There will be no second primary, I guess is a way to say it.
There will be no runoff in any.
Yeah.
There's no runoff in the election.
It's a great incumbent protection act that's been put into place by the GA. I don't know why they saw the need to go further. I mean, all they had to do was deal with the maps and get out. As always, though, when you put a bunch of lawmakers in Raleigh, they're going to do more. And they did more to advance some of their political careers and give themselves an option that they didn't have to spend a lot of money raising money for the past few months or anything.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, there is. Never underestimate a legislature's ability to self-serve. So in that case. And on that topic, the Connect North Carolina bonds, it is an interesting thing to see what's happening. What I see happening is counties are passing. They're passing these you know, support, not support, but they're passing anti-bond measures and resolutions at different places in Republican counties. What it looks, I still think the bonds are going to pass, but that part of the Connect NC that means there are no roads is bothersome, and it's starting to gain traction out there. And now you've got people coming out and saying they're against it, openly saying they're against it, even though his citizens are going to go there and saying, we don't need to borrow $2 billion. There's enough money in the budget and with growth that we can fund all these things. Plus the number of people going to the colleges will probably stabilize over the next few years. Why are we putting more bricks and mortar? We have Project Phoenix in North Carolina that seems much more important with the aging infrastructure and buildings of the state. And also, you know, people seem to be more interested in roads and bridges, for which this has nothing in it about roads at all. There is no connect in the Connect NC.
Right. I almost feel like the proponents and advocates for the bond, it's a race against time for them to get to the bond date of the election.
Yes.
And get it passed, because every day seems to bring about greater opposition, increased opposition, as people become more aware of all those things that you mentioned. State Representative Chris Millis has a letter to the editor of the Star News today. He calls to attention to the fact that the UNC system, there's a study from the Pope Center, UNC system's only using about 18% of their classroom seats throughout the whole UNC system. So why do we need more buildings? Nicole Revels, who's leading the opposition to the bond, and I know you've had her on your show.
Right. We're working to get Chris Sinclair, who is heading up. He's a paid person that is helping for the bonds. We'd like to get him on. Nicole Revels is a volunteer who's decided to take up this cause and travels all over the state.
I don't think there's anybody paid to run the opposition campaign.
There is no paid opposition, yeah.
I just went and got my mail before I came on the air with you, and this is the first flyer I've seen supporting the Connect NC bonds. There's a photo of Governor McCrory on it, and it says, Connect NC bonds will keep our NC National Guard on the ready. Support the NC National Guard on March 15th. Vote for the Connect NC bond. And then on the opposite side, it's a glossy little flyer with a National Guardsman on it with some military vehicles. So, you know, I forget how much of it is supposed to go to that National Guard project, but
I got
a
note. I got
the kind of advertisement they're using to promote the bond. And really, this is a very small part and a very small project of the bond.
I got a note from someone who attended a Wilmington meeting where I don't know which specific meeting it was, but it was a highly attended meeting, and someone was speaking in favor of the bond. I'm assuming, I don't know if they were a volunteer or paid, but the question that was asked that got to me was, is there any money in this for roads? It says Connect NC. Is there any money in roads? The person did not address that answer and just went on to start talking about the universities. And then at this meeting, they handed out, and I'm holding in my hands, 1, 2, 3, it is, just because you said you had received something. So there are 5 pages of sample letters to the editor that they're asking people to submit. So in other words, they literally want you to copy and paste these letters to the editor from the pro bond side. And then they've got sample speeches to local speakers bureau, and they literally have written speeches for people to go and give.
Yeah, and somebody.
In other words, don't use your own words. Use the words that we are paid to give you.
Right.
Don't speak from the heart. Speak from our words.
I don't hold that against them necessarily, because that's a typical campaign activity of both liberals and conservatives on all kinds of issues. You know, sign our petition or put your name on this statement and submit it, and it goes through to whoever it's supposed to go to. But, you know, you've got even the newspaper editorial pages supporting the bond and doing everything they can to promote the bond. But of course, because that creates, you know, more projects, more news, more activity and public civic pride in their areas. There was a piece in the Morganton News Herald that I saw today. It was from a couple days ago, but it was a Burke County commissioner who was given over 1,100 words to promote the bond on the op-ed page. I will tell you, having dealt with op-ed pages for, you know, at least 15, 20 years, nobody gets that number of words. Whether it's for or against the cause, whether the editorial board's sympathetic or not, nobody gets that amount of wordage to state their piece on any issue. So it's amazing how much coalescing is coming around the bond and is going into this effort to get it passed.
I'm looking at, by the way, I have the thing from NC State. So one of the questions that came up the other night in the Mark Ville Nelson Dollar face-off in Western Wake, and Nelson Dollar, the appropriations chair that's being challenged in a primary, is the issue of the bond. Nelson Dollar tried to say that the bond money is specific to projects at all of these universities. Mark Ville was saying, hey, look, it is not. It is very general in nature. So I'm holding now, and I wanted to get to the bottom of that. And so this is funny because I'm looking at this, and it says it has all of the community college listed. So it's got all of them from College of the Albemarle, Central Carolina Community College, McDowell, Mayland Community College. So if you look at the description of the projects, it says new construction, repairs, renovations. There is no specific project that this money is just going out to everyone. And it's not, I mean, in some of them in the university system, there's very specific, but like there is another one called Statewide Various. In other words, various. Doesn't tell which university, and it just says capital repairs and renovations. That's $45 million.
But well, I think the UNC system, there are some specific projects.
There are.
The community colleges, there are none. Nicole Revels tried to get a list of the projects from the governor's office, and the governor's office told her, well, you're going to have to go to all the individual community colleges to get what they are.
The National Guard gets 4%. That commercial that you whatever ad you got. But the community college get $350 million, none of which is designated for a specific project.
Right. And the so-called water and sewer infrastructure projects, that's just a pot of money for local governments or entities to apply for. And politicians or bureaucrats will decide who gets what.
That's $309 million for those. And those should be local projects anyway. So for all of the cities and counties out there that spent money on their water sewer infrastructure with property taxes, and now the taxpayers of North Carolina are going to be saddled with that instead. So I guess the state government's going to pick and choose who the winners are to get special money from all of North Carolina rather than the property taxes in their given community. So I'm just kind of surprised, and especially that the legislature kept the Connect NC name. You know, this is, and again, I've seen bonds before. I've supported bonds. I mean, I haven't had in my county. I actually helped defeat one in my county. We went back and saved a bunch of money and did the project with $10 million in savings. But in this particular one, the problem that's most just gets to anybody I talk to is the fact that they're leading people to believe there's roads in it, that the legislature, not the governor, but the legislature kept that name. That's the part that's so disturbing.
That's the most objection. One of the most objectionable things about it is they called it this so they could message on that. They, you know, fine. You want to promote a bond. You want to promote and try to persuade the voters of North Carolina to pass this referendum. Okay, do it based upon what it is, what it actually is. If it's the UNC system, if it's the UNC buildings and classrooms, go ahead and justify it. Go ahead and call it what it is. You know, this is a flyer that I've gotten. It says, you know, support the National Guard. It's a minuscule part of what this bond is.
4%.
But it's really 4%. All about supporting the military, you know?
Right. So anyway, it's interesting. I think as days trickle by, the Democrats are strong. I think they could have made the bond for, you know, $10 billion, and the Democrats across the state would have supported. Republicans, every day that goes by, Republican support for this is dwindling. So they're in a race against the clock. I think it'll pass overwhelmingly. But if this bond were put off till June, it would be in serious trouble.
Yeah,
because the more people know about it, it's not the more they know, the more likely they are to support it. The more they actually know, the more they're inclined to not support it. Very interesting. So out there in the world, and I'm sure you're going to be running more about this. A last question for you really is going to be about what's your take on what you think will happen? Well, I was going to ask you about these legislative maps, but do you see this becoming a much bigger issue or just kind of going away? I think it's going to be approved and everyone's going to settle in and no one will really pay attention to this.
To the new maps?
No. Yeah. I think the new maps are going to be adopted and most people are going to say, okay, who's running for Congress? And then the races will come up. I mean, then it'll be done. I mean, I just don't see there being a lot of gnashing of teeth like we will in the Charlotte bathroom story. I think that one's going to be much bigger.
Yeah, well, I think it'll settle down. I think it's interesting. I know you talked about this already, but George Holding challenging Renee Elmers, she's in serious trouble. And I think it'll be interesting to see whether the Republicans are claiming pretty strongly that they're going to be able to maintain their 10-3 advantage in the congressional seats.
I think that there are one or two seats. Yeah, I think it is too. I think that especially the sixth, when you look more closely at that, it's much more evenly aligned than it was before, but we'll see. Paul, thanks for being a part of the broadcast.
Always fun. Thank you.
Paul Chester from the CarolinaPlotHound.com with us. It's our Wednesday afternoon. Coming up next, we're going to talk to Professor Andrew Taylor about some stuff that he's written about what the economics of are for the two parties at the national level, this huge disparity between the way they look at taxes and things. We'll talk with him next. Much more to go here on this stormy afternoon in North Carolina. Stay tuned.
For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. The National Weather Service is investigating two distinct tornado paths that crossed through St. John the Baptist Parish in Louisiana. One of the paths goes through a community where as many as 200 homes were damaged late yesterday. To the west, a tornado ravaged an RV park and convent, killing two people and injuring about 30 others. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards told WVUE, the devastation left by the storm is unbelievable.
The saying is, a picture's worth a thousand words. It is a jumbled mess. These travel trailers were picked up, moved considerable distance, and really blown apart, torn apart.
The storms killed another person in Mississippi and damaged about 100 homes in Pensacola, Florida. Thousands in the Gulf Coast region are still without power. That same line of storms is bringing the threat of straight-line winds and tornadoes to our state today. The Nevada Republican Party is reporting that attendance at its Tuesday night caucus set a new record. The party says more than 75,000 voters attended the caucus. That's more than twice the 33,000 who caucused in 2012. Nevada's Republican caucuses have been plagued by low attendance and other problems since they began in 2008. Democrats have seen stronger turnout numbers. They reported more than 84,000 caucus goers in their caucuses Saturday. As expected, the relatively high turnout Tuesday powered Donald Trump to a commanding victory. After his win, Trump greeted supporters at a rally.
We love Nevada. We love Nevada. Thank you. Thank you. This is a great place.
Marco Rubio took second and Ted Cruz came in third. Rubio and Cruz have been attacking each other viciously in recent days, an indication they know Trump can be stopped only if one of them is eliminated. After winning now in New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, Trump has momentum heading into Super Tuesday. Elsewhere, Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid has endorsed Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination. Reid participated in his state's Democratic caucuses Saturday, but voted as uncommitted. Reid said he took pains to remain neutral in the competition between Clinton and Bernie Sanders so he would not be accused of rigging the caucuses. Speaking of elections, locally, Time Warner Cable News will debut Decision 2016, Make Your Vote Count, a special on North Carolina's voting process this Friday, February 26th at 7:30 p.m. Anchor Tim Boyum, who you can also hear every Friday right here on What Matters at 4 p.m., and the network's news team will provide viewers with a comprehensive overview of North Carolina's political parties, break down the changes in the state's voting laws, and offer a thorough look into voter resources. The program will be re-aired several times throughout the weekend. A federal judge gave opponents to North Carolina's congressional redistricting maps until Monday to outline their objections. The News and Observer reports U.S. District Court Judge William Osteen Jr. asked the plaintiffs to state with specificity the factual and legal basis for each objection. The plaintiffs sued the state over its 2011 maps that redrew its 13 congressional districts. A three-judge panel ruled February 5th that the maps were unconstitutional and ordered the state to come up with new ones. The plaintiffs now argue that those newly drawn maps passed into law last week by the General Assembly are no more appropriate than the versions that were struck down. They proposed a schedule for the court to review the new maps, which included court hearings March 11th, and a final decision by the court no later than March 18th, and also recommended the judges draw their own map if they don't like the new boundaries. The legislature had proposed candidate filing under the new maps begin March 16th. Defendants have until March 7th to file a response to the plaintiff's objections, and plaintiffs have until March 9th to reply. The judge said in his order any request for more time would be viewed with disfavor. If the new maps and filing period remain in force, North Carolina's congressional primaries will be June 7th. And there's a gathering taking place right now, and it's not what you may think. 50 or more bald eagles can be found in the cold of winter at Jordan Lake, a 14,000-acre reservoir near the RTP. The miles of undeveloped shoreline are a natural habitat for the eagles. For the national bird of the United States, the hunting there is good. Jordan Lake has more than a dozen active nests this winter. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now back to more of What Matters with Chad Adams.
And welcome back to the second hour underway here at What Matters with Chad Adams.
Amidst all sorts of stormy weather all over the state of North Carolina, hope you are safe no matter where you're listening, and hope if you're listening in podcast or in the replays that everything went well for you today. With us right now, Dr. Andrew Taylor from North Carolina State University, a frequent guest on our show here at the Institute of Rational Thought. He also happens to work, like I said, at NC State. I'm a Wolfpacker. We love him doing both gigs. How are you today?
Pretty well, Chad. You?
I am wonderful.
Good,
Couldn't be better.
Good.
By the way, you're also, I need to say, Dr. Andrew Taylor. You're a professor of political science at the School of International and Public Affairs at NC State. Now, you have a column you released earlier this week that I think is quite interesting, and you make some economic arguments, but not all the way through. And I also want to talk to you about the primaries. But let's first get to your column. Growth equality issues will shape the campaign. You're referring to 2016. So tell us a little bit about the inspiration for this article and what made you come to these conclusions.
Well, you know, I'm looking at sort of general themes with the candidates on both sides of the aisle. You know, at this stage of the campaign, we're focused largely on internal party battles. So people are pointing out significant differences between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side, for example, and on the Republican side, picking out significant differences between, I guess we're really sort of down to five or six now, but between Senator Cruz and Senator Rubio, for example, and both of them and Donald Trump. But what I had wanted to focus on is are sort of differences between the parties rather than within them, and sort of commonalities between Republican candidates and commonalities between the two Democratic candidates, and what that says about what would be an emerging theme in a general election, regardless of who the nominees were. And I think what you really do see, particularly when they talk about economic policy these days, is that there is a sort of mantra amongst Democrats to sort of really focus on the issue of economic inequality. And sort of from that is the idea that because we have this amount of economic inequality, the way forward is really to try to equalize outcomes more. Presumably a good way to do that would be to take from the wealthiest and to give to the poorest, which is a sort of a redistributive.
It's not a sort policy. Of redistribution. It is redistribution.
It is a redistributive
policy. It's not
policy,
sort of.
Where tax rates are increased on those. And, you know, they are. We argue over who, but they would say on the top and then redistributed down towards the bottom. And then Republicans are much more focused on growth. So here the argument is that we have this pie. And what we really need to do is, rather than take a slice from one group's slice or one person's slice and give to others, we need to grow the pie.
Right.
And make the pie larger. That would do a number of things. Presumably, it would increase everybody's slice. But it also might decrease some people's slice as well. I mean, it doesn't mean that necessarily everybody's going to grow. When you have a growing pie, the dynamism that you need to grow a pie can actually lead to greater equality or greater inequality. That's in some ways sort of secondary to the idea of growing the pie.
And getting into your article, and I like the way...
Chad, that's the growth argument, right?
But in the article, it's interesting because you go from something that's fairly easy to understand, and then you go back into, you know, a theory of justice by John Rawls and others. But let's start out with the basis, which is what you just kind of articulated for the GOP. To me, as we move past, the real question, and I'll have this in a second, is, so do these respective positions beat a path toward each other when the general election begins to roll around? Because you said on the GOP, you know, the taxes must be reduced, simplified, or spending cuts. Job and wealth creation will occur only with economic growth, a force unleashed not by government, but a robust business community with resources available to reinvest in capacity. I thought that was very succinct, well said. Then you write on the Democrat side, self-proclaimed socialist Bernie Sanders has a spending wish list estimated at $18 trillion over the coming decade, including a single-payer health system, tuition-free public higher ed, and paid family and medical leave. Now, it's interesting because I see the only way Bernie could be successful is if the GOP was first. It seems like you can't redistribute wealth if there isn't any to redistribute.
Right. Well, you can immediately. I mean, you could go if the government really wanted to go in there and do it. I guess it could be done, right?
Yep.
But the point is that, so in the short term, Bernie could, you know, you could get that. But in the medium or long term, that's not sustainable. obviously. And this sort of gets into the second part of the argument about what I brought in Rawls and Nozick, that, you know, the real problem with the sort of democratic argument or the equality side of the debate is if you... and I'm simplifying here, but I think the general point is true.
And the book, by the way, on Rawls's book is The Theory of Justice from 1971 that you mentioned. So I just, in case people want to look it up, I want to mention
right,
that.
Right. And Nozick's sort of retort is Anarchy, Utopia, and the State, which is, and this is a very famous discussion in the, between philosophers in the 1970s. Nozick is really seen as a sort of one of, if not the most influential philosopher for libertarians. The argument against this sort of equality side is that if you have outcomes that are predetermined, which equalizing outcomes does, then you don't have incentive to grow the pie, right? You don't have incentive to be productive because your outcome, that where you stand in society, is predetermined for you. So why do anything? Right.
Doesn't matter. No matter what you do, you're stuck.
Right, right. And so, and that's problematic for the, in the aggregate, and it's problematic for the growth argument because then, you know, you don't do anything because you're stuck, and therefore the pie slowly shrinks and shrinks and shrinks and shrinks. So that's, you know, and that's the sort of the basic, in a nutshell, simplified a little bit, but in a nutshell, that's the criticism of the sort of equality uber alles argument. In the end, you get equality, but everybody's equal at a very low state rather than equal, which is presumably people with good intentions, right?
Right.
The goal of equality is to have everybody equal at the top end, but unfortunately you get everybody equal down towards the bottom.
And this is interesting, and then you go on to say that you believe it's kind of in the middle. I mean, you make a point of saying that, look, you know, if it's that Nozick says that inequality is really unimportant so long as commercial exchanges are voluntary and economic outcomes reflect the distribution of effort and talent. That's a very libertarian. It's a very free market approach to things.
Yes.
And you say, well, to a point, until you have a problem with extreme inequality. And you say extreme inequality is the issue.
Extreme inequality in itself isn't a problem, but it is what is problematic is when you don't have mobility, right? So as we noted, the problem I argue with Rawls is that he has an incentive problem, and we just said that. If you have equality, then people don't have incentives to do anything. But you also lose that incentive if you have extreme inequality where, and this is the proviso, extreme inequality in itself isn't problematic, but where people don't have really any meaningful chance to do better. Right. So in that case, they also say, well, what's the point of getting out of bed in the morning? I'm stuck in this station. In fact, that happens for the very wealthy. I mean, if you can't get poor, if you can, as someone who owns, you know, a massive corporation, you're making really, and you can't make bad, and you don't get punished for your bad decisions because you just keep rolling along, then again, there is no incentive to be productive, and of course the pie shrinks. And that's, I think, the concern that for many of us who are conservatives have about extreme inequality. We don't worry about extreme inequality in itself, but we do worry when it becomes ossified and when social mobility... because that was the great American success story, right? When, you know, the Horatio Alger story, when you have this great ability to make it from nothing, from go from rich rags to riches. You should be also be able to go from riches to rags. If that stops, then you have that problem that you don't have the incentive to be productive.
And you talk about that both respective parties and their candidates kind of recognize some degree of this, and this is where I think they kind of move together, and I think we'll see more of this when you talk about, you know, Kasich wants to expand the earned income tax credit, Rubio wants a new child care credit, Carson and Trump both want to exempt people in the bottom one-third from paying any individual income tax. I think most people couldn't tell you that that was the position of these candidates, and then you talk about Clinton talking about growth and fairness. I find the whole discussion of fairness to be very problematic. I know it sounds cool if you're like an eight-year-old, but it's never mentioned anywhere in the founding documents. The word fairness doesn't appear, so kind of bizarre that that is what they talk about. Now, the question I have for you, you say this, Republicans tend to get that we desperately need growth better than Democrats. Without it, efforts to equalize outcomes become punitive and divisive. I would argue, and you tell me where I'm wrong, when I look at where the taxes are coming from, when you have the top 20% of earners in the nation pay 84% of income taxes, and the bottom 25%, not only do they not pay income taxes, they receive more benefits than they put into the system. This is, you know, it's hard to say we have extreme inequality when people are being subsidized to exist. I mean, am I missing something there?
But it depends on which metric you use, Chad.
It's all in the perspective.
Now I will say this, that a lot of on the left, a lot of the metrics used are before transfers. All right. And so you can exaggerate the amount of inequality in existence by just sort of, say, talking about basic income or wealth measures. After transfers, which is kind of what you were talking about when you teed up this question, certainly the amount of inequality that exists is less. But regardless of which metrics you use, we have been becoming more unequal. Now, you're also right in when you say about the amount of income tax paid is not clearly, you know, not even. And in fact, there are individuals who don't pay income tax. In some ways that's a little bit simplistic, because I think we should think of taxes as a whole rather than just think of in terms of income tax. So we should think in terms of sales tax, which of course we don't pay at the federal level, but there are also payroll taxes, of course. I think when you think about the tax burden on people, the picture you paint isn't completely washed away by this, but it's still sort of in place. But what I'm saying is, it's the sort of hard edges of what you said are taken off a little bit when you think about taxes as a whole, because governments take taxes just because they don't, you know, they might take more from you in payroll tax than income tax.
Yeah, but they get
Right? It doesn't really matter in what form they take. They are still taxes. So when we take that into consideration, you know, the picture that you paint isn't quite as stark as the way you paint it, but I think it's still, you can largely still see it. The picture that you said, that there is that people at the top end are paying.
But you mentioned incentives, and there are, I think one of the problems we have is there are some incentives to not break through income barriers.
Exactly.
That are negative incentives to
exactly growth. And that's why we have to incentivize work. That's why I think things like the earned income tax credit is a good thing. I mean, this was President Reagan's, you know, that you, instead of saying here's a transfer for not working, you say you've worked, and unfortunately, you know, the way things are at the moment, perhaps you're not being remunerated as much as you probably should be for working. So what we're going to do is we're going to work on the revenue side, on the tax side, to say this is the kind of behavior that society values. And so instead of making you think, oh, maybe I should stay at home and not work, we're going to encourage that kind of productivity.
It also encourages cash payments. And you and I, you know, we look at this, and this is the truth. If you're in, I don't know, let's say you're a dance instructor, or you teach some stuff on the side, it encourages more cash transactions because you can get that earned income credit by staying beneath certain thresholds and not having to declare as much income. It's a very interesting system. Whereas if we were more consumption based or flat tax based,
but what you're just saying there would encourage everybody. I mean, that's why, you know, hedge fund managers try to do certain things, right? Put certain income in certain categories rather than others, because you know, you're just trying to beat that bracket. It's not just, you know, dance instructors in the cash economy.
How about Steve Jobs, who made $1 a year? You know,
that incentive exists for everybody, right? That's the problem. That incentive, which is why maybe, you know, you're going to a consumption base, but maybe if we stayed on an income based one, we should have a flat tax, right? So you don't have those incentives to try to sneak between or in certain brackets, because it's an evenly applied flat tax.
Well, Well, it is fascinating, and it's interesting that you didn't bring too much economic theory into it. You touched on it. You touched on more philosophy than economic theory with Milton Friedman and some other folks. But having looked at what's happening in Nevada, let me pivot a little bit here. Because yeah. I think you're illustrating that there is a significant, there is a stark, and you mentioned that I was a little more stark on something, but you would agree that there is a stark difference between what the Democrats are saying now vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, and if they introduce anyone else into the race, and what the Republicans are saying, even though there are differences between them and they're beating each other up on stage, from an economic taxation growth standpoint, there are very stark differences between these two approaches.
There's no doubt about it. There's no doubt about it, Chad. In fact, I think they've been as stark as perhaps they've been for
ever.
Some time.
Yes. I do not see any commonality here. In fact, when Bernie Sanders is talking about creating all this free stuff, it's interesting that the word free never really gets picked apart except in political discussions. But you'd think more pundits would say, it's not free. Nothing's free. The college tuition isn't free.
Right, right. I mean, when my Bernie students say that, it's beautiful teaching political science in the presidential election year, particularly a place like NC State, and I give NC State kudos for this. We've got a pretty politically diverse student body, and so I've got all my types in there. When my Bernie students say that, I just tell them, I'm not working for free. I love this job.
No doubt.
I think it's important what I do, but I'm not doing it for free.
No, you're not. Bernie Sanders said you could.
Bernie wants me to do it for free. Unfortunately, I quit. go ahead.
But let's look at this now, and let's pivot a little bit to the actual election. We love to talk to you about this stuff. Our guest, Dr. Andrew Taylor from NC State University, a professor there in political science, now an author of books and just a really neat guy. So we're looking at this. Trump, I don't think there was any doubt a guy that has a tower in Nevada won the caucus in Nevada. But looking ahead to Super Tuesday, do you see – is there any obstacle – that really derails Trump heading into Super Tuesday? And the second question to follow up is, when I look at Bernie Sanders now, what I see is just more of a nuisance to Hillary Clinton than a serious threat. I'd love to hear your comment on both of those things.
Yeah, well, it's just next Tuesday, Chad, so it's harder to think that there will be anything in the way of Trump and doing very well in the Super Tuesday states. If you look at polls in those individual states as well, they're fairly uniform. And so it's difficult in 5 or 6 days to think that anything like that would happen. It's getting pretty desperate now. And I think for the anti-Trump contingent, which is very, very large and very, very influential in the Republican Party, but it's had very, very little success so far, it's starting to get not irredeemable, but we're getting to the stage where this could be a real problem. The only thing that the anti-Trump group has in its favor at the moment is that those primaries, although they're in lots of states, those primaries on Tuesday, those states still are distributing their delegates on a proportional basis.
Right.
And so Trump can't run away with it yet.
No, but I mean Georgia, Massachusetts, Oklahoma, Michigan.
Texas, Cruz should, of course, Cruz should be
there's
able
about
to
5 points. Cruz has about a 5-point lead on Trump in Texas, his home state.
Yeah, in fact, in some ways, if you think about it, if you really are rooting against Trump, you don't have any specific favorite, let's say, between Cruz and Rubio, you might even want Trump to winning in Texas, because it seems as though a Cruz candidacy, or the rationale for a Cruz candidacy, if he loses Texas, is gone, which would galvanize, presumably, anti-Trump group behind Rubio. And in a two-horse race, perhaps that's the only way that Trump can be stopped.
It also is interesting because I think one of the failed assumptions that many people made was, hey, as these people get out of the race, everybody's going to coalesce behind Rubio or Cruz. I don't see that happening. I see that those votes are going to – there are some people that are going to Trump, some that are going to Rubio, and some that are going to Cruz. They're not coalescing behind any given candidate.
Yeah, and by the way, I'm guilty on that front as well, Chad. I've said in many places, and I think I've said to you on your show, that I really thought that those kinds of things would happen. And I'm red-faced and – I admit a mistake. I was in that school of thought as well. But you're right, and a lot of the polling is now showing that argument that Trump had a high floor but a low ceiling, a solid support, but everybody else who was voting against him was clearly anti-Trump, and so all we needed to do is to get to a two or three horse field, and so that anti-Trump vote could coalesce. That thesis is not totally wrong, but it's not as compelling as it once was. And you're seeing in the polling that there are a lot of Cruz and Rubio people who have Trump as their second choice and would defect to Trump. And that Trump's negatives are softening.
Right. That's irritating to many on the right, and especially in the more intellectual circles on the right, like National Review, that pretty much put their entire reputation on. Look at us. We're smart. Trump's a bad guy. Vote against him. And then Trump proceeds to win New Hampshire and South Carolina. So,
and he's drawing across. I mean, there's really interesting data that shows that, you know, a lot of people are voting for Trump because they believe – you know, they believe they like the anti-establishment thing. But there are a lot of people who are voting for Trump because they believe he's the most conservative candidate in the race.
And they believe he's unafraid.
There's a lot of people who are voting for him because they believe he's the most moderate candidate. I mean, this sort of ideological chameleon nature that he has is really working for him. You know, it's sort of, you can look at Trump and you can, he's a sort of personal therapist of everybody, every sort of slightly angry voter. You see in him what you want. He's this bundle of contradictions, but it's working for him at the moment.
Oh, I think the immigration he's tapped into. This is what it often astounds me, and I'm certainly not putting any chips in any camp. Okay, I've tried to be very agnostic with respect to the candidates, and to be fair to everyone, because what I find is people are really wed and they hate the other guy for some reason. They just hate everyone else except their guy, and it's kind of bizarre to me. When I look at this, Trump tapped into something on immigration and the economy, and he tapped into it at a very blue-collar level, a multi-billionaire with business interests in dozens of countries. He's tapping into this blue-collar sentiment. It's not just anti-government, it's anti-political party in many ways. And it amazes me that people aren't picking up on this. Cruz, I think, does, but I don't think Rubio gets it.
In what the response should be, you mean?
Yes, I don't think Rubio. So he's getting all the insider endorsements. I don't think they're going to help him that much. I mean, Tom Tillis jumping on the Rubio camp, Nikki Haley jumping in, all of these people in every state. But look at Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, jumped into Rubio camp. Still, Trump dominated.
And the people have made an argument that there was a little bit of a Haley effect that helped Rubio. It was late. The endorsement was late, but it probably made Rubio second.
And then with Cruz firing a staffer, I mean, the thing against Rubio where Cruz fires the staffer, this to me, I think, is yet another small problem for Cruz heading forward. It's like they're sniping at each other, and Trump just has got the SS Trump cruising through the electoral process.
Your point is that this may have some effect, but it's at the margins. The main story is Trump. I think people agree with that. I think what happened was, of course, that initially Trump's opponents thought he would just self-destruct. And then when they got to the stage when they realized that probably wouldn't happen, they thought, well, you know, you can't take on Trump because he's just different. I mean, the way we should think about winning this nomination is that there are types of candidate, and there are particular lanes that people are going to run in. And Trump's got his own, so let's leave him alone. Am I the establishment guy? Am I the fiscal conservative? I'm the social conservative. And so although the thinking about Trump changed dramatically, the opponents still weren't dealing with him. They were just not dealing with him for another reason. And now it's morphed into let's get him to me versus him. And then I'll deal with him. This is the sort of the Cruz and Rubio.
we'll deal with him later.
But then it might be. We're getting to the stage where that could be too late.
Astounding.
And undoubtedly, the next strategy will be let's change the rules at the convention.
And I believe they would do that at their own peril. The anger, it would be an explosion if they tried to monkey with the convention.
They would, but you know what? I mean, to be honest, I suspect if we do have a President Trump, I might be... if you don't ever see me again, what's happened. But that's a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation at the convention. Because I mean, I say this to many.
You're saying it with such clarity right now, Doctor.
Yeah, well, I'm saying it to many of your listeners, and I'm saying it to myself. And it's not news that we want to hear. But it is hard from this at this point to see Trump beating Clinton in a general.
Is it hard? But it's not hard for you to foresee Trump being the nominee, is it?
Not so much anymore. No. No, you're right. I still think it's less than 50% chance, but it's much greater than it was.
It's like this tornadic activity. It's a high probability. Yeah. So thank you for being a part of the broadcast today, all right?
Good to be with you, Chad.
Dr. Andrew Taylor from NC State University, also our fine, fine chair of our Institute of Political Studies here at the Institute of Rational Thought. Much more to go. We'll be back after this. We'll be talking about the CLC with Angela Hite. Stay tuned.
For Freedom Action Network News, I'm Lisa Price. The National Weather Service is investigating two distinct tornado paths that crossed through St. John the Baptist Parish in Louisiana. One of the paths goes through a community where as many as 200 homes were damaged late yesterday. To the west, a tornado ravaged an RV park and convent, killing two people and injuring about 30 others. Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards told WVUE the devastation left by the storm is unbelievable.
The saying is a picture's worth a thousand words. It is a jumbled mess. These travel trailers were picked up, moved considerable distance, and really blown apart, torn apart.
The storms killed another person in Mississippi and damaged about 100 homes in Pensacola, Florida. Thousands in the Gulf Coast region are still without power. That same line of storms is bringing the threat of straight-line winds and tornadoes to our state today. The Nevada Republican Party is reporting that attendance at its Tuesday night caucus set a new record. The party says more than 75,000 voters attended the caucus. That's more than twice the 33,000 who caucused in 2012. Nevada's Republican caucuses have been plagued by low attendance and other problems since they began in 2008. Democrats have seen stronger turnout numbers. They reported more than 84,000 caucus goers in their caucuses Saturday. As expected, the relatively high turnout Tuesday powered Donald Trump to a commanding victory. After his win, Trump greeted supporters at a rally.
We love Nevada. We love Nevada. Thank you. Thank you. This is a great place.
Marco Rubio took second and Ted Cruz came in third. Rubio and Cruz have been attacking each other viciously in recent days, an indication they know Trump can be stopped only if one of them is eliminated. After winning now in New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, Trump has momentum heading into Super Tuesday. Elsewhere, Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid has endorsed Hillary Clinton for the Democratic presidential nomination. Reid participated in his state's Democratic caucuses Saturday, but voted as uncommitted. Reid said he took pains to remain neutral in the competition between Clinton and Bernie Sanders so he would not be accused of rigging the caucuses. Speaking of elections, locally, Time Warner Cable News will debut Decision 2016, Make Your Vote Count, a special on North Carolina's voting process this Friday, February 26th at 7:30 p.m. Anchor Tim Boyum, who you can also hear every Friday right here on What Matters at 4 p.m., and the network's news team will provide viewers with a comprehensive overview of North Carolina's political parties, break down the changes in the state's voting laws, and offer a thorough look into voter resources. The program will be re-aired several times throughout the weekend. A federal judge gave opponents to North Carolina's congressional redistricting maps until Monday to outline their objections. The News and Observer reports U.S. District Court Judge William Osteen Jr. asked the plaintiffs to state with specificity the factual and legal basis for each objection. The plaintiffs sued the state over its 2011 maps that redrew its 13 congressional districts. A three-judge panel ruled February 5th that the maps were unconstitutional and ordered the state to come up with new ones. The plaintiffs now argue that those newly drawn maps passed into law last week by the General Assembly are no more appropriate than the versions that were struck down. They proposed a schedule for the court to review the new maps, which included court hearings March 11th, and a final decision by the court no later than March 18th, and also recommended the judges draw their own map if they don't like the new boundaries. The legislature had proposed candidate filing under the new maps begin March 16th. Defendants have until March 7th to file a response to the plaintiff's objections, and plaintiffs have until March 9th to reply. The judge said in his order any request for more time would be viewed with disfavor. If the new maps and filing period remain in force, North Carolina's congressional primaries will be June 7th. And there's a gathering taking place right now, and it's not what you may think. 50 or more bald eagles can be found in the cold of winter at Jordan Lake, a 14,000-acre reservoir near the RTP. The miles of undeveloped shoreline are a natural habitat for the eagles. For the national bird of the United States, the hunting there is good. Jordan Lake has more than a dozen active nests this winter. And now you're up to date. Stay informed with Freedom Action Network News. I'm Lisa Price. Now back to more of What Matters with Chad Adams.
Welcome back, folks. Our second hour, we're very pleased to have in the studio with us Angela Hite. She's been working diligently for months to organize the CLC, the Conservative Leadership Conference. So we wanted to get a recent update for you folks that are coming up there. Embassy Suites this weekend, actually next weekend, right?
Yes, this next weekend.
For 4th and 5th of March. But also thoughts and prayers to everyone impacted by this horrendous weather we've had all day today. So we're thinking about you and hope that you are okay. So with us right now, again, Angela, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm good. We're getting there. We're getting lots of interest, lots of tickets.
You have been a busy, busy lady.
Busy bee.
Busy bee, there's no doubt. And you've got people swarming about. You're getting, this is interesting because a lot of people have planned to come.
Yes.
We're going to have hundreds of people there. Embassy Suites there on Harrison, or right off Harrison Avenue.
Right by SAS.
Right by SAS on I-40.
Yep.
So if you're coming through, it's really easy to get to. Very convenient location. Great location. And you're getting more and more people that are announcing they're going to be there. So people like Dinesh D'Souza and David Limbaugh and others. The governor, I think, is coming. I heard this morning the governor's planning to come is what I heard. Lieutenant governor's going to be there. Council of State people will be there. Candidates running for statewide office are going to be there. There are going to be breakout sessions. There are going to be a VIP reception. There's just a lot going on.
Absolutely.
I don't know how you don't lose. You're so calm.
I know. I've got great people around me in the office, though.
You do. But I mean, you just seemed more frenetic a few weeks ago. Now you seem like you're in cruise control.
Yeah. I'm but you know what? This is the fun part. This is the part where it's people are starting to get ownership and that the pieces are coming together. That, you know, when we hit the ground running on Friday, it's just going to be nonstop. And so it's going to be exciting.
Are there still rooms available?
There are no hotel rooms available, but there are other hotels in the area. So you can definitely check that out. But tickets are still on sale. We have the Friday ticket available. We have Friday day ticket. We have the Friday night dinner ticket. We have the Saturday day ticket. And we have the full conference.
Yes.
But the best bang for your buck is to get the full
conference. I'm mad at myself for not getting the room. I'm just angry at myself because I meant to get one and I didn't, and I'm mad at myself. But that's the hazard. Look, a lot of people coming. This is going to be a great event. So, again, great event. So any other guests that you can mention? Francis was with us yesterday, or Monday, rather, and he couldn't say anything. He says, well, I'd like to say something, but I can't. Maybe Angela can tell you, you know. So post Dinesh D'Souza, do you have some others that you couldn't quite mention?
Yes.
So it's just between us. Nobody else listening. So I'm just kidding.
I do, but I'm not going to mention it yet.
Oh, but
so make sure you check your email. Make sure you check your
So you have other,
Facebook.
Is this a national?
Huge.
Or as Donald Trump would say, huge.
Huge. And yes, I lifted my eyebrows up when I said
you
that.
You have to say it like
huge.
That.
Huge. And I put my arms out to the side.
Is there the potential for presidential candidates to be stopping in? There's always that because they usually don't do it till the last minute.
Just check your email.
Just check your email. But
you
will
not be disappointed.
There is a big announcement coming is what
big.
You're saying.
Huge.
I love the way you said that.
I like the huge.
Tell us a little bit also, because we have talked about the dinners, we have talked about the folks, the elected officials, but there are sessions. This is a conference. There are actually classes that people will go to where they can learn about different things.
Absolutely.
So can you give us an idea about what kind of classes are going to be offered at this that people will go to? Because you're going to be around people that think like them.
Absolutely.
Politically.
So there's different things. You know, one thing, the Helms Center is bringing in a speaker, George Dunlop, who worked under Reagan. You know, so he will be there. We have Jimmy Kemp, Jack Kemp's son, who's going to be there talking about different things. We've got Paul Vallone, and we're going to be talking about Second Amendment rights, you know, guns. I mean, that's one of the things.
So there'll be a session, in today's society when, you know, the left is going after guns front and center, even going after gun manufacturers trying to put them out of business. You know, this is a big issue.
Yeah. Well, and then you've got Donald Bryson, you know, from AFP, who's on here all the time.
Who was here yesterday.
Yeah, he was here yesterday. And he's going to be talking about energy politics in North Carolina.
The Free the Grid. He's taking a tour across North Carolina. It's going to culminate at the CLC.
Absolutely.
That'll be fun.
You know, and Tim Phillips, the president of AFP, is going to be speaking.
National organization.
Yeah, national organization is going to be there Friday morning breakfast. Speaking.
Most people don't get to see Tim except on Sunday morning shows.
And he's great.
And once a year at the Defending the American Dream Summit in D.C. or elsewhere.
Yeah.
But he'll be here in North Carolina.
I mean, Heritage Foundation will be there. Ryan Anderson is going to be speaking at Friday Breakfast. And Hans von Spakovsky is going to be speaking
there. We had Hans on the show from Columbus, Ohio. But again, not someone you're going to get to see outside of these national conferences. But they're going to be here in North Carolina.
And exactly. Brandon Darby, you had him on there.
Yes, we did. And you
Breitbart.
Helped get that.
Yeah, he is amazing. If you've not heard his story, I mean, he kind of lives under the grid.
Off the grid.
That's what I'm looking
off
for.
The
off
grid.
The grid. On the border. You know, he was outed by the liberals and he's on a watch list. And his story is amazing. So he will be speaking twice, once on Friday, once on Saturday.
On the Mexican US border and his stories there. Very interesting.
It's just he should have his own reality TV show.
And a special shout out to you as well. By the way, we were in Columbus, Ohio, doing our first real big remote for this broadcast that started on June 9th, and we were there. You were at the Defending the American Dream.
It was fun.
You were so instrumental in helping corral guests, make sure things flowed. And a special thank you. Lisa was back here making sure things were working, but you were very instrumental in helping keep the show on the rails that day. Because the Radio Row had like 30 different booths.
Yeah, and I actually was running some other people's programs too at the same time.
How you got drafted into that, and you're not even an AFP employee, was beyond impressive.
But it was kind of fun.
So as people get closer, how many folks do you think are going to be at this? There's always several hundred.
Yeah, I mean, we're over 500 at this point.
Over five. This will be the biggest one ever.
We're hoping,
This will be the biggest gathering of conservatives in
North
Carolina.
If you have not gotten your tickets yet, like I said, read your emails, follow social media. This is probably going to put us over the edge.
Wow. And this, I can't think of a large one. I've seen a couple rallies where people come in for an hour or two to see a big rally, thousands of people. But as far as a conference, this is the largest conference of its kind in the state of North Carolina that I can think of.
Yes.
There's not one. There's no other national organization that does. There's no other conservative organization in North Carolina that does a conference like this.
I don't think so.
No, this is the largest gathering of conservatives in the state of North Carolina over the course of 2 days. That the state's ever had.
Yeah, and we've got people not only from North Carolina, I mean, all over North Carolina, I should say that, first of all. But there's a gentleman coming from, there's one from D.C. coming that bought a ticket. Somebody from Pennsylvania.
Oh, you mean attendees,
attendees of Pennsylvania. We've got somebody from Missouri.
And the media will be there. Sometimes there's protesters. I remember that at times there are protesters out looking at this and going after folks.
That's, yes.
It's just like... Yes, there are protesters that come from time to time.
So there's a lot of different things going on. I mean, I can go on forever. Sabrina Schaefer.
Are they going to have one on social media? Social media is a way that many conservatives are reaching out and making sure information gets out. Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all the other social media tools. And are we having something on that?
So actually, AFP is doing a technology room. So it will be open on Friday, 9 to 5. And so there will be people in there all day long kind of helping you. So if you can't even figure out your password on Twitter, somebody will be in there helping you. How do I become relevant on Twitter or Instagram or
Jenny Qualley is a big Twitter user down in the southeast part of the state. And I think she was planning to be there.
Yeah. So there's going to be, and there'll be little independent ones as well. I mean, and then you're going to have people there from, you know, we have Demi on our staff. So if you've got
Demi Dowdy, who's also a frequent guest on Closing Arguments with Elliot Engstrom on this network.
Yeah.
That show comes every Friday. She's going to be there. She's great with social media.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you have questions, seek her out. Find her name tag or come find me and say, Angela, who's this Demi person? You know, and that's and she'll be able to help you. So, I mean, there's a lot going on. I mean, Tom Rogan is going to be doing how Bernie Sanders is affecting this generation. You know, he has the best sense of humor, too. Can I tell you this? He's the funniest guy you'll ever meet.
Really?
But he's amazing. He's intelligent as well. So if you like those type of breakout sessions that's relevant, that's to the point, and you know, it's a big issue of how do we get the next generation involved. He's going to be a great one to talk about.
Now, it kicks off Friday.
Yes.
And what time does it start?
Breakfast starts at 8:30. We open up registration and every check in at 7 a.m.
And there are classes all through the day, and then there's a big dinner that night with a lot of speakers.
Yes. So
right?
at your meal, so your breakfast, lunch, and dinner, breakfast, lunch on Saturday, there's speakers. So you'll be eating and listening to speakers. But in between there, there's also going to be these breakout sessions that we're talking about. And we also are going to be having a book signing table. So a lot of these people are bringing the books that they've published. Jimmy Kemp, you know, we'll have Dinesh D'Souza's books. David Limbaugh, who's going to be there Saturday afternoon, is bringing his
Rush's
books.
Rush's brother. People have asked me, are they related? Yes, they're brothers.
Yes, they're brothers. And he's he does a lot of Christian apologetics, too, and how that relates. You know, Tim Daughtry will be there, Waking the Sleeping Giant. He's another great one to listen to. Hans von Spakovsky will have his book. Ryan Anderson will have his book. I mean, there's a lot of books. We're also showing Anne McElhaney's Frack Nation again.
The independent film.
Yes. But she's also going to be having a sneak peek of Gosnell, her movie that's coming out.
Now, these are independent filmmakers that have a conservative belief system. And a lot of them were done for the Atlas Found, for Atlas, years ago. But these are movies. I mean, Call of the Entrepreneur is one of these great movies. But this one should be good. They're great filmmakers. And so you're going to be able to get a screening of that? The whole movie or just part of the movie?
Just the Frack Nation, we will have the whole movie.
Wow.
But we'll have a sneak peek of the one.
Of the new movie.
The new movie coming out.
Well, that should be very interesting. Anything else you would like our audience to know? Because, again, big speakers Friday night, Saturday lunch, throughout the conference. And by the way, for those of you interested, a lot of the Council Estate and the people running for Council Estate will be Saturday after lunch.
Yes.
And they will be, if you are interested in hearing candidates, and maybe you don't know a lot about these candidates, please come out because you'll get an opportunity to meet, not only just hear them, but probably to meet them. They'll be wandering around through the halls and talking to folks.
And a lot of them are spending extra time here with that as well. The last little things that I would add, if you don't mind, visit the webpage civitasclc.com. Civitas, CIVITASCLC.com. You can register for your tickets there, find some bios and things of speakers.
Right.
Or you can call the office, ask for me, 919-834-2099. Or you can email me, angela.height, H-I-G-H-T, at nccivitas.org.
Again, our guest. Okay, keep going.
I was going to say, any question you've got, just give me a call
or wonderful to email. Work with. Angela Height, our guest here, and thank you for all you do for this. It's going to be an exciting time. We're going to have you on again next week before it happens, okay?
I might have no hair by then.
That's okay. Hey, baldness is completely excusable on radio.
Oh, you can't see it.
I have a face made for radio, so that's why I love radio. So,
there you go.
Thank you so much, Angela Height. Much more to go. We're going to take a quick break, finish up the show for the day. Now, keeping an eye on the weather. Hope you guys are safe and sound out there. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Attention, conservatives. Don't miss your chance to hear from former Congressman Colonel Alan West, Lieutenant Governor Dan Forrest, Anne McElhaney, Dinesh D'Souza, and David Limbaugh March 4th and 5th. The Civitas Institute invites you to the 2016 Conservative Leadership Conference in Raleigh. Get your tickets online at civitasclc.com. That's CIVITASCLC.com. Join the Civitas Institute and hundreds of fellow conservatives to hear from inspiring leaders and dynamic speakers from the Heritage Foundation, Americans for Prosperity, the Civitas Institute, and many more. Go to CivitasCLC.com. That's CIVITASCLC.com. It's time to stand up for the principles that made our country great. Learn how at the 2016 Conservative Leadership Conference, March 4th and 5th at the Embassy Suites, Cary. Register at CivitasCLC.com or call 919-834-2099. That's 919-834-2099.
Welcome back, folks. Glad to have you with us as we're wrapping up the day. It has been a hectic day from a weather standpoint. Lots of storms, lots of tornadic activity, lots of everything. It is one of those bizarre, you usually don't see days like this unless you're in the spring. Obviously, we're still in February, so a rather bizarre day. Hope you all are safe and sound no matter when you listen to this, no matter where you are in North Carolina, but it, and certainly in the central part of the state. all up and down the southern, southeastern, everywhere. It's been rather bizarre, but we're glad you're with us, and we appreciate that you have made us a part of your day. Now, a couple things I want to get to, not too many things, as we head toward the top of the hour here. The redistricting situation is clear as mud, and I know a lot of people that listen to the show are more insider-oriented, and we're thankful for that. Many, but your common North Carolina voter, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean folks that just are trying to make ends meet, take care of their kids, get them to ball practice, feed the dog, water the cat, whatever. They're not really in tune with all of this. Most of them can barely name who their current congressman is. And so all of this shifting of lines, all of this is really an insider game because we're, after all, we're talking about the primary. The primary that was going to be March 15th for Congress now will be at least June. And the people who filed the court briefings to get it, the districts redrawn, have filed additional court briefings and are trying to go at it again. In all likelihood, the maps that are now the new maps will likely be the maps. Now, that doesn't mean it can't change because the courts can do any number of things. And depending on who you speak to, they can give you a wide variety of opinions. But here's the thing that hasn't changed. Before the maps were drawn, Renee Elmers, Congresswoman or Congressman Renee Elmers, was probably the most vulnerable of the entire delegation in North Carolina. Her record had been assailed. She had become the example of someone who goes to Washington and then becomes enamored with it and becomes kind of – Renee Elmers was elected as a Tea Party darling. I mean, she took on Bob Etheridge. She received a lot of conservative support, opposing Obamacare, linked to Americans for Prosperity. She had the widespread support. Oh, took out an incumbent, someone who was steeped in government. Bob Etheridge reeked of government all the time. Big government guy. I've known Etheridge for many years. Big government guy. She was that darling. And it shows she is illustrative of what happens when you get around a lot of power, when you get around a lot of money, when you get around a lot of things that make you think that you've become something that you weren't necessarily. I've known Renee Elmers for many years. Very nice individual. The fact that she finds herself in this situation is due to her own voting record. And here's the sad reality. As much as the districts were drawn in such a way that removed every single one of her opponents from her district, some may still file in the district, but there's no doubt that George Holding, Congressman George Holding, will be the most formidable imagined opponent she could have. He has money. He has a more conservative record. He has name ID. He was drawn out of the district, but he's very familiar with most of what is now the second district. And my prediction, if it is a Holding versus Elmers race, he will crush her. And that is a prediction I feel very comfortable making, that George Holding, someone who took on the Raleigh establishment, someone who has deep pockets, someone who can raise money, who has a very conservative record, much more so than Renee's, than Congressman Elmers. So in a Holding versus Elmers primary, it could be bloody, and the eventual nominee would likely be Holding. And just for what it's worth, I know there's a lot of other things going on today. There's much more we could discuss, but this is kind of front and center. And what's going to happen in the 6th District, the maps were changed at the last minute to put Congressman Walker back into the 6th. Really, almost the line goes right down his street. I mean, to draw him back in, they literally drew a line to put Walker back in his district. It remains to be seen what Jim Duncan will do, but certainly other people are weighing in, and it may be that we have more congressional primaries than you can shake a stick at. Senator Brock, Andrew Brock from Moxville-Davie area, he is now signed up to run in the 13th, the new one. And by the way, the maps, and with all due respect to the General Assembly that drew these maps, that new 6th congressional district that's been drawn, much more Democrat than it looks like came out of the General Assembly, because they were using information from the Board of Elections, which is dated and is not. If you scrub that data and you scrub out a lot of these, that race is winnable by a Democrat. So the Democrats could actually pick up a seat by picking up the 6th, because that could be a very close race. Now, like I said, there's a lot more going on. I think we're going to have a robust primary season. It will be long. It will be expensive. It will be crazy. And it will be low turnout election. It will be anemically low, because how many of you, not you, well, you guys will vote. You're listening. You're insiders. Whether you're in business or in government, whether you're in the trades, whether you're a lobbyist, whether you're a member of the media, and we appreciate the members of the media that listen to the broadcast. But come June, how many of your fellow North Carolinians are going to be thinking about going out and voting in a primary? So this, if the grassroots across this state, Democrat or Republican, are looking for the potential to win a race, these congressional races will be the place to do that, unless things change markedly. Grassroots insurgents have a more than better opportunity to upset the apple cart. So it's going to be a fascinating thing to watch. It's going to be very, very interesting to watch, and we look forward to it. Now, getting to the end, again, anything can happen to the weather. We're certainly thinking about you folks. I was going to talk about and still would like, because as we're going into this, one of the most important issues, whoever you support for the presidency, whoever you support in your House and Senate districts, and we'll be talking about a lot more of this in the coming weeks, there is something I want to make sure we convey, and that is the power of entrepreneurship and the degree to which both parties deal with that topic and often misinterpret what that means. They, you know, a lot of Republicans love incentives and they think that's it, but incentives don't really go to entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs have to go through the red tape, have to go through everything that set up all the obstacles in front of them, not to mention the myriad of potentially bad ideas that cost them money in the process of creating a business. John Tammy over at Real Clear Markets has a very good piece about this today, and it's called Unleashing the Life-Enhancing Genius of Entrepreneurs. And he said he starts out this way, it's probably hard to imagine in the present, particularly for young readers, but there was a time when ownership of an automobile marked you as a rich robber baron. Possession of a computer signaled that you were a tech genius with enormous sums of money. And then a wireless mobile phone at the ear indicated that you were a very rich and showy, probably a Hollywood movie producer. Thanks to entrepreneurs and their endeavors, all of these big things are that only the rich could have, you have. Most Americans of all income classes have those things. What this should remind us is that rising inequality, now I want you to think about this because it's a big deal. A lot of people talking about inequality right now. Rising inequality wrought by entrepreneurship, far from making us worse off, is the surest sign of all that the lifestyle gap between the rich and the poor is shrinking. So as we hear about income disparity, think about the lifestyle gap, the things that you have that rich people also have. Entrepreneurs grow rich by virtue of commoditizing the luxuries of the elite so we can all enjoy them. In that case, the ongoing goal, think about this, you political types, the ongoing goal should be to remove the barriers erected in the way of the very entrepreneurs whose innovations will unquestionably improve our lives and living standards. In other words, we should be focused at the political level of removing the obstacles to entrepreneurship. The Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation is a Kansas City-based organization founded by a very successful entrepreneur, the late Ewing Kauffman, with an eye on encouraging more in the ways of innovative behavior. There aren't many causes nobler than this one. Indeed, imagine what our lives would be like if there were 100 individuals around the world achieving in the way that the late Steve Jobs did, or the way that Jeff Bezos or Michael Dell continue to. We need more entrepreneurs, not few. So what they looked at is, what do we do to unleash these things? So when you talk, they had a discussion with the folks from the Kauffman Foundation. They basically said that the path to more entrepreneurialism is very basic. So you political types, listen up. Reduce governmental barriers to the frenzied experimentation that leads to new products and services. All the while, reducing the barriers. Now, listen to this. This is important about immigration, and it's a good one. So not only do you reduce the barriers from government, but reduce the barriers to immigration that keep the world's risk takers from reaching the U.S. In other words, if you're finding the most innovative entrepreneurs, why wouldn't you want them here? Entrepreneurialism backed by talent will never reveal itself if experimentation is too expensive. In other words, if the red tape makes it too expensive, if I want to be an entrepreneur, I'll never bring that product to market. You'll never hear about it. And for those who live under repressive governments, both will similarly be suffocated if there's no way to express your gifts. So that's what we should be doing. There is a relentless pursuit. What makes us great and what ultimately will make North Carolina, I've believed this for many years, if North Carolina becomes the place for entrepreneurship, if we strike down the impediments, think about all these boards and commissions we've set up that really do not contribute to creating jobs. They stifle innovation. They stifle creativity. We are focused so much on giving big government handouts to big companies that we forget the guys that create the next company, that create the next Dell, that create the next Apple. They're out there struggling every day. We need to make it so they, male, female, can get out there and make a huge difference. We need to figure out what those barriers are and focus on it. And in a day where we have crazy weather like this, on a day where we have so much political uncertainty, look at our presidential election. You're looking at the electoral maps here. We just had a special session of the legislature. It's going to be a crazy year. But I hope, it is my sincere hope, that as we move forward, through this electoral process, that you will ask these questions. I mean, even in the entire energy discussion, it astounds me to this day that Republicans cannot get rid of the renewable energy portfolio standard. They cannot get rid of certificate of need. Both of those things are hurting entrepreneurs. Both of those things are standing in the way of competition. Both, think about certificate of need. If you've got the next great innovative thing, maybe you could do medical diagnosis. You've got apps that create a clinic where people can come in and get medically diagnosed for a dollar. You have to get the permission of the government to do it. And you have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to go through a ridiculous certificate of need process. This is one of those examples that we're killing ourselves with the regulations. So when you get into the election process and there's some incumbent out there saying, vote for me, ask them those tough questions. Say, what are you doing to get rid of the impediments to the entrepreneur? Because that is what they're doing. Folks, have a great day. We're at the top of the hour, and please be safe out there. Hope you and your family are through this crazy weather situation. We'll be back bright and early tomorrow afternoon at 3. So always check us out here at What Matters with Chad Adams on the Freedom Action Network.